Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. President Trump addressed the Iran crisis today.
By removing Soleimani, we have sent a powerful message to terrorists. If you value your own life, you will not threaten the lives of our people.
Congresswoman Lori Trahan joins us to talk about Iran, fresh out of a classified briefing with the White House. She'll take your calls. And we'll hear from a former White House counterintelligence expert on where we go from here. Plus, the Lowell Spinners campaign to save the team's relationship with the Boston Red Sox and Major League Baseball.
We help grow the game of baseball. We make baseball accessible to young people throughout the region.
That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston. This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Iran bombed two bases in Iraq last night that housed U.S. troops. No one was injured, but it was Iran's boldest attack on America since the 1970s. President Trump addressed the strike today from the White House, and he had a message for Iran.
As long as I'm president of the United States, Iran will never be allowed to have a nuclear weapon.
To discuss both this evolving situation and other issues for Congress, we're joined by Congresswoman Lori Trahan. She represents Massachusetts' 3rd District and serves on the House Armed Services Committee. Congresswoman, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Oh, thank you for having me, Tiziana.
And you can call the Congresswoman. Call us with your thoughts. How do you feel following last night's retaliation or hearing the president's reaction to it today? What would you like your congressional leaders to do next? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So, Congresswoman, the president's remarks were not long today. He said a lot of different things. A couple of the highlights: that the general killed in last week's drone strike should have been killed a long time ago, that the death sent an important message to terrorists, and he warned Iran against its nuclear aspirations. What were your overall reactions to his remarks?
Well, you know, first, I just want to start by saying how grateful I am that no American or Iraqi troops or civilians were killed in last night's attack. I think we were all scared for them, as well as their families here at home. And, you know, I want to be clear. I share this with many of my colleagues. I don't want war with Iran, and the American people don't either. You know, just a few hours ago, the president did address the nation, and he signaled what appears to be a possible freeze and immediate hostilities. And this is welcome news. It's imperative that we take this moment to pause and that cooler heads prevail and we start talking about engaging NATO. But we shouldn't lose sight of the truth that this didn't have to happen at all. And we are not out of the woods yet.
Let's talk about the drone strike. You just said it didn't have to happen at all. Today, the president reiterated that General Soleimani was planning an attack on U.S. interests. There really haven't been any further details either last week or this week beyond that. But you and other members of Congress got a briefing from the administration today. What can you tell us about that or other key information?
You know, we were just briefed by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and Defense Secretary Mark Esper, among others, and I've also read the classified report that the president sent to Congress. And, you know, while I cannot get into so many of the details, it is not clear to me that the justification for the attack on Soleimani was based on a truly imminent threat to the American people. I mean, the current situation in the region is a tinderbox of President Trump's own making through his maximum pressure campaign.
Although it's been a tinderbox for at least a couple of administrations. Really, one might argue that it's been a tinderbox of one kind or another since 1979.
Absolutely. We could go back through history, but I want to be clear-eyed about the fact that this whole spiral began with President Trump's decision to pull us out of the Iran nuclear agreement. Their attacks on shipping lanes, their shooting down of our drones, and the uptick in skirmishes with their Iraqi-based proxies, which tragically led to the death of an American contractor, they all trace back to that decision. We had been trending in a positive direction while we were participating in the JCPOA. So, you know, this is it very much became more of a tinderbox in the last, 18 months.
You mentioned the Iran nuclear deal, the JCPOA. The president made a point of suggesting today that last night's bombing was tied to that and agreements President Obama made. Here we go.
The missiles fired last night at us and our allies were paid for with the funds made available by the last administration.
Now, we know that's a claim that's been made for a while. And to be clear, the funds that were released after the JCPOA were Iranian funds, not American funds given over. But what do you make of the fact that the president reiterated that argument in an address to the American people today?
You know, I'm not going to get into trying to analyze this president's obsession with the Obama administration, but I will say this: look, for too long, Congress has allowed presidents to conduct or bring us to the brink of war without congressional approval. This trend of Article 1 ceding power to Article 2, it didn't start with Donald Trump, but his handling of this current crisis is the clearest example we've seen of why we in the 116th Congress have to do something about it.
To that point, CNN is reporting that Representative Catherine Clark says the House hopes to vote on a war powers resolution this week. It would call for removal of U.S. armed forces from hostilities with Iran that aren't approved by Congress. Is now the time to do it, and will you support it?
Yeah, absolutely. So we don't know yet when it will come to the floor, but when it does, I will absolutely vote in support of the war powers resolution to limit the president's military actions regarding Iran and reassert Congress's long-established oversight responsibilities when it comes to deploying military assets. In fact, I've previously voted to terminate the 2002 AUMF and against any funding for conflict with Iran absent a new AUMF or official declaration of war through the committee that I sit on. So, you know, it's clear to me and I think to so many others that the stakes are too high. We've come too close to the brink of yet another endless war to not take stock and change our course.
The Obama administration arguably pioneered drone strikes years ago. Should Congress have pushed back much more firmly and much sooner on presidential powers in this and related areas?
You know, like I said, I do believe that for too long Congress has abdicated its power on the use of military force. And we are in uncharted, territory in terms of using those AUMF powers that are outdated, frankly. The administration should come and make the case to Congress, for any time that they're going to use military force. We cannot risk being in another endless war without, that proper due diligence.
So, I'd like to take a call. We have some callers getting ready to come in. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Rick on the line from Newton. Rick, what's your question to the Congresswoman?
Hi. First, I'd like to agree with the Congresswoman about what got us into this situation and the intent of President Trump to get out of the Iran agreement that was working and that he just basically wouldn't acknowledge. But my question is that the Democrats, unfortunately, have been ineffective in their ability to rein President Trump in any way. If anything, it prods him into taking action and doing things that are detrimental as far as I feel. I wonder, does the Congresswoman agree that pressure from our allies, Germany, France, England, would be the most effective way if they were to unite and say to the United States, say to President Trump, we're not putting up with this any longer?
Let's give it to the Congresswoman to respond, Rick. Thank you.
Thank you, Rick. Absolutely. I mean, look, I think that there is a lot of consensus around engaging with NATO, talking about peaceful solutions, working with our allies so that these are not unilateral decisions made by this president who, you know, frankly, this has been a very disjointed and erratic foreign policy on a whole host of fronts. And, you know, it's it's absolutely true that, you know, we should not be going this alone. When we first got into JCPOA, we did that in concert with the global community, and I think that's what made it strong. And, you know, prior to our withdrawal, Iran was compliant with the agreement that had been that had been struck with our international partners. And, you know, we have to get back to that place. That is when our foreign policy works best.
Let's stay on NATO for a minute. Here is the president today calling on NATO to take, you know, a bigger role in Middle East peace.
Today, I am going to ask NATO to become much more involved in the Middle East process. Over the last 3 years, under my leadership, our economy is stronger than ever before, and America has achieved energy independence.
We know America still imports about 15% of its oil from the Gulf region, but he's making this tie between energy dependence and strategic interest and allies in the Middle East. How do you comb that out or prioritize that?
So I think that it was welcome news to hear the president talk about our NATO allies and the leverage that they have in these ongoing negotiations. I think the question then becomes, is he going to, you know, is he going to act that way? You know, the president has, unfortunately, a history of, you know, sending out tweets and not exercising restraint and going it alone. I'm sure that our NATO allies are, you know, they're ready. They're ready to, you know, work in concert. They, you know, they want global security as well. And right now, this region has been destabilized by his doing. So I think, look, these are our allies who have worked across administrations on bringing peace to this region, and are, you know, we've got common interest here. The question is he going to use those diplomatic tools the way other administrations have?
So I guess as I'm listening to you, part of what I'm thinking is other administrations, let's say from the Bush administration forward for this conversation, have used a range of diplomatic tools in the Middle East. And it has remained messy and it has remained complicated. We have heard some argue that this more sort of bloody nose approach may be necessary and important as a step in dealing with the strategic situation there. Is that possible? And what do you say to that framing of what's happening now?
No, I think the president has only shown, you know, that he can use these blunt force instruments, right? He's used sanctions to, you know, as part of his maximum pressure campaign, but with no articulation of what that is intended to do. Is that supposed to bring Iran to the table to get them into a better deal? There has been no, there's just been no cohesive, articulated, or clearly not a well-understood strategy. And I think that's what's different about other administrations. I mean, when we have a strategy, then we use all the tools at our disposal. We use our diplomatic tools. We use our allies. We use our trade policy. We use so many of the things beyond sanctions and military force, and certainly we don't antagonize our partners by going out and tweeting in the middle of the night to openly antagonize a regime that is not acting, you know, in accordance with the norms of others. And so I think that's the difference. There is no cohesive strategy. There is no engagement with our allies. We have this moment. I mean, we're fortunate right now that we have this moment to pause and to collectively take an approach that will de-escalate tension in the region. And I think that it's really important that, you know, this president treat this moment with the preciousness that it is.
I know.
Go ahead.
Well, I know you can't, there's a lot you can't talk about in what you heard in the briefing you heard today. But we're after the briefing and you are referring to the administration as having no strategy, which makes me think that you didn't hear anything in the briefing today that would lead you to believe or feel comfortable that there is a coherent strategy going forward. Am I correct in surmising that in what I'm hearing from you?
Yes, I haven't heard anything that would indicate to me that there are certain goalposts that we are working toward outside of, you know, the what we often hear, which is Iran to behave like a normal nation. You know, we need more than that. We need to understand exactly what the performance metrics are that we are working toward. And that's not clear.
Today. Let's take another call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join our conversation with Congresswoman Lori Trahan. Jim is on the line from Watertown. Jim, go ahead.
Yes, with all due respect, I think the Congresswoman has it backwards. I think Trump ultimately wants to get the troops out of Iraq, and that's what he's planning to. And I think he saw Soleimani as the chief obstacle to getting the troops out. I think that he's finally exercising some judgment and has a plan and strategy to precisely get the troops out. So for the congressperson to now say they're going to put constraints on Trump, he's already doing what they say they want to have done. It's like anything he does, though, they criticize. He's finally making progress by showing our strength, what we can do, and we don't want to do it. But we had to get rid of Soleimani because he was probably the biggest thing holding Iran back.
So let's invite the congresswoman to respond, Jim.
Go ahead. Thank you, Jim. Look, there's no question that Soleimani was an unquestionably evil man with the blood of countless American service members on his hands. But the question before us wasn't, was he a bad person? It's rather, was this strike going to make us more safe or less? And, you know, this administration does assert that this was done to protect Americans and to avoid a war, not to start one. But just think about in the days following this strike, what we've seen. Last night, there was an Iranian counterstrike. The Iraqi parliament, you know, has passed measures to expel U.S. troops. The, you know, Americans are evacuating from Iraq. U.S. and NATO forces announced the suspension of all counter-ISIS operations. You know, our own government is issuing warnings of an elevated threat of attack, and Iran is getting closer to acquiring a nuclear weapon. So, and 15,000 more troops are, you know, in the area today than there were 6 months ago. It's just hard for us to claim that we're safer today or that we're withdrawing from this region today. You know, when clearly all those indicators are going in the wrong direction.
So what do you think the strategy should be? What do you think are some key elements of what the U.S.'s strategy should be given where we are right now?
You know, I think this is when, you know, and I know I've said it before around engaging with our allies, but this is where we need our diplomats. This is where we need people who understand the complexity of this region. And
Do you think we have the diplomatic corps that we need in place right now? You know, a number of experts we've talked to over the last few months have suggested that, especially with Iran expertise, that a lot of that's been gutted.
Yeah, I think that we've seen on display, even in the last, you know, 6 months, the caliber of diplomats that we still have at our disposal. Whether they're being deployed is a different question. Whether they're being listened to, whether their counsel is being sought out, that's a different question. And frankly, that's the reason why we want Congress to be engaged, so that we can ensure that we're using our diplomacy and our diplomacy first and foremost. This is the time where we've got an opportunity to change course here and to come up with a strategy to get you know, back to a place where we were with the JCPOA and start having some targets so that, you know, we can move forward. And I just haven't seen that to date. I don't like the fact that we've got 15,000 more troops in this region today than we did 6 months ago. And I certainly don't like, you know, the activities that we've seen in the last, you know, 2 weeks. So I think we've got this is an opportunity for us to change course and to set a strategy for the region.
We've heard some reports of Iranian nationals and Iranian Americans with U.S. citizenship, including some Massachusetts residents experiencing issues at ports of entry. And this is even before the death of General Soleimani. Have you heard such concerns from any of your constituents, or do you know of people who are having those problems?
Yeah, no, we're deeply concerned about that. I mean, it's just not, you know, who we are as a country. And we're monitoring certainly what we've been hearing, especially up on the Canadian border. But we haven't received a case ourselves yet. But, you know, we stand ready to help whomever of our constituents who call. But, I mean, just, you know, first and foremost, it's just not who we are as a country, and we need to you know, we need to make sure that, you know, we are calling that out, and we have to make sure that we're rectifying what's happening on our border and across the country.
Okay, we've only got you for a couple more minutes, so let's switch gears. I do want to ask, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has said this week that he has the votes to go forward with a Senate impeachment trial that doesn't take witnesses right up front. Is it time to move forward with the trial now?
Well, let me start by saying, you know, the full weight of history is on Congress right now, specifically Senate Leader McConnell and the Senate Republicans. I do believe that they are, you know, out of excuses. I mean, every single argument that they've made against holding a fair trial, including subpoenaing documents and hearing from fair witnesses, has just fallen apart. You know, with every day, you know, there's new and incriminating evidence that's uncovered that substantiates what we already know, and that's that President Trump abused his power for personal and political gain. This alone demands a fair trial with documents and witnesses. I mean, I know many of my colleagues have already said it, but it's worth repeating. You know, trials have witnesses and cover-ups do not.
So switching gears again, the House Ethics Committee has extended campaign finance investigation against you about whether $300,000 loaned to your campaign in 2018 came from your husband, which is above the $2,700 that was then allowed in the primary or general elections. You have said since the beginning of the inquiry that the money came from a shared account. What is your reaction to the investigation being ongoing?
Absolutely. So there is an inquiry that was based on a politically motivated complaint from a right-wing organization that exists to basically attack Democrats like me. But it's why I've been completely transparent with my constituents about my use of personal funds in my campaign. And I have nothing to hide here. I mean, anything anyone would want to know has already been put forth months ago in the Medium piece that I wrote. Certainly, you know, the legal response, which we released, also, you know, reinforces, you know, what we've already said. You know, I'm fully cooperating with the Ethics Committee, and I remain confident that when they have the opportunity to review my inquiry, it will be resolved favorably.
Before we let you go, in our last minute, you held the first public meeting to save the Lowell Spinners yesterday. We'll have the owner of the Spinners on next. But according to a leaked report, it looks like the team could lose its major league affiliation with MLB's plan to eliminate some small clubs, although the Globe has said maybe also they could be saved but no longer be affiliated with the Sox. What would it mean to Lowell for the team to both keep its affiliation but not with the Red Sox?
You know, the Lowell Spinners are as much a part of our community as, you know, our national park, you know, the Merrimack River or UMass Lowell. And part of that is the affiliation with the Boston Red Sox, which is why we're working so hard on, you know, on two fronts, right? We obviously don't want to see Major League Baseball wipe out 42 minor league teams. It would be devastating to communities like Lowell from an economic perspective, but psychologically and culturally, you know, it's just been such a huge part of our city. But then certainly, you know, there's it's great to have the Red Sox affiliation. It is the world.
I'm so sorry. I got to break in for you there. Thank you so much, Congresswoman Lori Trahan. I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
Hey, stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Before the break, we heard from Congresswoman Lori Trahan on the effort to save the Lowell Spinners. The team was one of 42 minor league baseball teams who Major League Baseball proposed cutting ties with in a plan that was leaked last fall. Major League Baseball disputes the accuracy of the leaked document. Radio Boston spoke just a bit ago with Dave Heller, the Lowell Spinners owner, and he began by talking about the team's future.
right now, today, we exist. We're playing in 2020. There's no scenario under which we're not playing in 2020. And like all 160 minor league teams, we're waiting to see what kind of agreement gets done between Major League Baseball and Minor League Baseball, and that will determine the future of each of the 160 clubs.
Is there some speculation out there what that agreement is likely to be?
Oh, there's a lot of speculation, and a lot of people have a lot of different ideas. Major League Baseball, right, they proposed cutting 42 teams. They wanted to go from 160 teams down to 120 and then bring in two independent teams, so that's how you get to 42. But that's just their opening proposal in a negotiation that has to be agreed to by both sides.
Do you think that's what it was? Do you think it was a salvo of sorts to start a negotiation process that
list?
Yes,
I do.
Now, the Globe is reporting from an industry source that, quote, current thinking from Major League Baseball is that it would retain Lowell as a full-season single-A affiliate, but maybe not affiliated with the Red Sox.
Yes.
Have you heard anything about that, and how do you feel about that?
Well, I've read what you've read, right? How do I feel about that? I certainly like the fact that we've gone from we're on the contraction list and we're going to be wiped out under Major League Baseball's initial proposal to now they're still looking at 120 teams. They haven't increased the number of teams, but they've rejiggered it and looked at the situation and apparently heard all the things that we've been saying that Lowell ought to exist. Lowell has a great ballpark. Lowell's a great community. We have tremendous support. We have a great relationship with the Red Sox. We have a wonderful history. We're a well-run club. By any metric, we ought to exist. And apparently Major League Baseball has gotten that word. And so that's encouraging. Like, I certainly think we're in a better place today than we were a month or two ago.
So would not being affiliated with the Red Sox be a deal breaker for you or for the city or not?
Well, I don't know about a deal breaker, right? That Major League Baseball has never guaranteed anybody's affiliation with any one team, right? Major League Baseball says, we guarantee you the affiliation with someone. It's up to you to put that relationship together. And, you know, what we would do under that scenario is we would reach out to the Red Sox, whom we have a great relationship with and a long storied history with, and try to make sure that we were meeting all of their needs and basically give them a godfather offer, right? An offer they can't refuse. Why would they want to go anywhere other than Lowell?
So for listeners who may not follow baseball as closely as you do,
yes,
or even as closely as I do, how should people understand the relationship between a team like the Lowell Spinners and a Major League Baseball team like a Boston Red Sox or, I don't know, something across the country,
right.
St. Louis Cardinals?
Sure. So there are 30 major league teams, right? And there are five levels of minor league baseball right now. And each team has one affiliate at each level, right? So 30 times five is 150. And then there's an additional level, the rookie level that the Appalachian League plays in, and they have 10 more teams. That's how you get to 160 teams right now. Major League Baseball's proposal was, hey, we don't need five or even six teams. We only need four. So let's wipe out a level and these other 10 teams, and let's go with 120. And minor league baseball has said, no, that's not really fair to these communities, and these teams do a lot of good, and you need to develop players. We should be allowed to continue to exist.
And just for listeners to understand, there is a difference between minor league baseball and major league baseball. They're not the same organization, and they are the two parties that are in negotiation.
That's exactly correct.
And how would you feel if some other team dropped off the baseball planet instead of the Lowell Spinners? You said, you know, still 120 on the list,
yes,
but now you're not on the 42, which would mean someone else is.
Well, we certainly don't want to see anybody go, right?
Why? Why? I mean, if there's that many teams, why is it so bad if some other team goes?
Because I really believe that minor league baseball is a key way for how we grow the game of baseball. Major league baseball has been bleeding attendance over the past few years. And minor league baseball's attendance, almost 42 million people last year. That's a lot of people.
How come? How come minor league baseball is so strong in communities?
Because it's affordable, fun, family-friendly entertainment in a way that major league baseball isn't. And there's a warmth and an intimacy there that you just can't replicate in a major league park. You see little kids line up before the game, and they get to meet these players, and they get their autographs, and they get their picture taken with them, and they get a bat signed. And those guys, those players, in some cases, they move all the way up to Fenway. Jackie Bradley Jr., Andrew Benintendi, Mookie Betts, the entire Red Sox starting outfield, they all started with the Lowell Spinners. And we're proud of that.
So one of the things that intrigues me about baseball in New England, mm-hmm. we're New England. We have one pro team.
Yes.
We have long winters.
Yes.
We don't have a big state school system yes. at the college level, et cetera. And yet, we feel so baseball.
Yes.
So what does our region contribute to the game?
Oh, listen, I think the Red Sox Nation is unlike any other fan base in the country. Even at our level, even at the Lowell Spinners level, I own four minor league teams. People will come to our other games in my other parks, and they'll come for five innings, six innings, have a good time, and then they'll leave. But in Lowell, they're baseball fans, and they stay to the end. They stay for nine full innings. And when there's a walk-off double to win a game in the bottom of the ninth, that place is still full, and those fans erupt like crazy.
So what would Lowell lose if it lost the Lowell Spinners?
Oh. You're talking about an organization that, in terms of its economy, over the past few years, we've spent literally millions of dollars with local vendors. In a city of 100,000 people, how do you replace that? We employ nearly 200 people between full-time, part-time, game day people. If Congresswoman Trahan, who is one of our strongest advocates, if she were to persuade a company that had 50 jobs, 50 employees to move into Lowell, right? She'd be having a press conference and bathing in applause as well she ought to, right? That's a big deal to bring 50 jobs to Lowell. So the idea that all of a sudden 175 or 200 jobs could just, boom, go out the door, that's scary for Lowell. You know, that doesn't even begin to talk about the philanthropic impact of the Spinners.
So I hear that urgency, and I understand as an owner, you have a sense of urgency for yourself, for the team as well. You did say that attendance...
For our fans, mostly.
You did say that attendance in Major League Baseball has waned,
yes.
let's say.
Yes.
So, you know, it is understandable that the league might say we can't keep doing things the way that we've been doing them. Is there some outcome that you would find acceptable that recognizes the realities of Major League Baseball as well as the realities of this unique space in a community that a team like the Spinners occupies? You own four teams, so we're not just talking about the Spinners here. As
Correct.
An owner.
Correct.
What's the outcome that gets everybody where they need to be in
well,
your mind?
So let's address the premise of your question first, right? What you said was, hey, you acknowledge that attendance is down, so maybe the economic realities are such that Major League Baseball can't afford to support minor league baseball.
That is what I said.
Right. But here's the real reality, that while attendance is down, Major League Baseball just signed a $1 billion apparel deal with Nike to put the swoosh on the jerseys, right? That's on top of their multi-billion dollar broadcasting contracts and everything else.
And they did have their most profitable year last year.
Correct, before those deals, right? So Major League Baseball is making more money as a whole than it ever has before, even as its fan base gets narrower. Or at least the fan base that attends games. So I don't know that I agree with the premise that we minor league baseball need to make cuts. Think about this. The New York Yankees last year made $700 million gross, right? It cost a major league team about $350,000 to operate a minor league team like the Lowell Spinners, right? So we're talking about, as Bernie Sanders might say, we're talking about one half of 0.1% of a major league team's gross income. One half of 0.1%. Do you know what the Spinners spend one half of 0.1% of our gross revenues on?
You're going to tell me.
Toilet paper.
Okay, fair enough. All right, so that gives good perspective. So yesterday, big community meeting in Lowell.
Yes.
Congresswoman Trahan, who you know we're speaking with
yes.
today, was there to save the spinners.
Yes.
What's coming out of that meeting? What happens now?
So what's coming out of that meeting is Major League Baseball, as evidenced by the Globe article, right, is saying, hey, maybe we move too quickly with regard to Lowell. Maybe we need to look again at Lowell because there really is something special happening there. And that's what we hope for.
In your last, 10 seconds, what's your message to fans of the Lowell Spinners?
Please come to our games. This year more than ever, it is so important that we show Major League Baseball that we have the support of our fan base. Our tickets are only $4. Come to Little Asher Park. Have a great time. Enjoy good food, cheap beer, and the chance to meet the future stars of tomorrow in Little Asher Park today.
That is Dave Heller, president and CEO of Main Street Baseball and the Lowell Spinners, Boston Red Sox short season A affiliate. Thanks for coming in.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Nice to be with you.
And Radio Boston reached out to Major League Baseball as well today. They sent us a statement which reads in part, quote, MLB fully recognizes the importance of professional baseball to communities throughout the United States without a major league team. And as our national pastime appreciates the support of the tens of millions of fans in our country. And later, quote, we remain confident that solutions can be reached that satisfy the interests of all stakeholders. You'll find the full statement on our website, radioboston.org. I'm Tiziana Deering. Stay tuned. There's more ahead. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We heard today from President Trump on Iran following missile strikes by Iraq against U.S. forces based there.
We suffered no casualties. All of our soldiers are safe, and only minimal damage was sustained at our military bases. Our great American forces are prepared for anything. Iran appears to be standing down, which is a good thing for all parties concerned and a very good thing for the world.
And I just want to make sure I said that exactly right. We heard from President Trump on Iran following missile strikes by Iran in Iraq, where U.S. had bases. Just want to make sure I said that right. So the question is, where does this leave our strategy and how do we move forward now with Iran? For more, let's turn to Joel Brenner. He is the former Inspector General of the National Security Agency and head of U.S. counterintelligence in the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. Now he's a senior research fellow at MIT, and he joins us via Skype. Joel Brenner, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for inviting me back to Radio Boston.
I appreciate having you. So let's start with the situation we're in. First, given everything that's happened in the last week, we've got a drone strike that killed General Soleimani, Iran's response, and now what the president said this morning. Where are we on Iran right now?
Well, as you put it just earlier when you phrased that question, is where are we with our strategy? I think the question is, what is our strategy? And we're in a complicated situation, Tiziana, because everybody, you got to evaluate what's going on both tactically, but above all, strategically. And the strategic question is, do we want war with Iran? And one feared that the administration, which says it doesn't want a war with Iran, and I think that's right, and the Iranians don't want a war with us, was nevertheless acting in ways that might provoke one, because the taking out of Soleimani was really an escalation.
So let me stop you there and just ask you a quick question about that. Was there a known goal for the drone strike against Soleimani? And if there was a known goal, do you believe we accomplished it?
It's hard to say. Here's what we might – let's try to put the best face on what the administration did. And I say that as anything but an administration booster here. But the administration believes correctly that the Iranian regime is weak, that is weak economically, that compared to us is very weak militarily. And it wanted to punch them hard enough to make them really back down from not only attacking our troops, but from attacking, further escalating affairs throughout the Middle East. And it remains to be seen whether that objective has been attacked, but it's very possibly could work. This was a big punch in the mouth.
So what do you think then was the goal strategically for Iran in the response that it chose?
The administration, look, either it continues to squeeze Iran with the idea that there'll be a war and we can win it. But I don't think that's what they want. Or they're trying to squeeze Iran. And then the question is, to achieve what? Because one doesn't see, at least visibly, any diplomatic initiatives that are being undertaken at the same time that we're engaging in force to try to negotiate some sort of modus vivendi with the Iranians. At this point, I wouldn't expect to see overt diplomatic overtures because I don't think the Iranians could possibly stand that.
Why? But
because they've already said, their leader has said, that negotiating with the United States in these while this pressure is being put on it would be a sign of weakness and they'll never do it. He said that. But it doesn't mean there wouldn't be behind-the-scenes negotiations through an intermediary, for example. And one would hope that that's going to start to go on. I mean, the Iranians have been, throughout in the Middle East, actively engaged in what you might call gray zone warfare. That, in this case, it's violent activities that are either below the level of armed conflict or below the level that would draw the United States into open hostilities. And they're doing it mainly through cutouts, through third parties, although in the missiles they sent yesterday were sent directly by them. And what the United States is now saying is, this is not going to be gray anymore. This is going to be black and white. So the Iranians have to really think hard about what sorts of violence they can engage in now that would not produce a retaliatory strike of a sort they can't stand.
So then let me ask you, are we safer today here in the United States, or are Americans, let me phrase it that way, safer today than we were yesterday and than we were last week?
You know, very possibly. It's going to depend on how this plays out. But, I have to say, this could work. This could work. For example, the Iranians had been
Let me time out for a second, because you've said this could work a couple of times, which is really interesting. What does it look like if it's working?
It means that the Iranians won't attack shipping in the Gulf, that they'll draw in their claws throughout the region, and won't attack our forces. We'd like, ultimately, if anything really works, it's going to have to result in some diplomatic engagement, and that we have not seen.
So you have said, as I noted, this could work a couple of times. What would have to be in place so that your sentence was, this will work?
Oh, I think I don't think anybody can say that, but what would have to be in place to make it more likely that it would work would be a diplomatic engagement. A willingness by both sides to engage diplomatically and to put on the table the Iranian nuclear program and Iranian activities throughout the Shia crescent that stretches from Tehran to Damascus.
I want to go back a little bit. I had asked you if we were safe, maybe we're safer. Have we seen all we're going to see in terms of retaliation from Iran at this point, do you think?
I doubt it. But you've got to remember that even I doubt it. Let's start with what the Iranians did yesterday, which was, compared to what we did, quite weak. It was a missile strike involving substantial missiles, but aimed at property, not calculated to kill people. It was a loud bang that didn't do very much, that allowed Trump to say, okay, that we're going to stand still right now. But the Iranians, even before this, were actively engaged in harassment of various sorts against the United States, not to mention Israel and Saudi Arabia. And I would expect to see more of that.
What might future harassment look like? What forms could that take or are likely to take based on your assessment?
Look, to go from milder to really extreme, you could see various kinds of cyber attacks. We've seen that before from Iran against American banks in 2012 and 2013 that cost, hundreds of millions of dollars to fight off. We could see that again. we could see strikes against cyber strikes against other soft targets. But Cyber Command, which is now on has much loosened rules of engagement, would retaliate against those.
U.S. Cyber Command, you mean?
U.S. Cyber Command, yeah. So even there, the Iranians, if they do something really more than a distributed denial of service attacks, should expect retaliation from us. That's it at the sort of one end of things. We could also see attacks against American businessmen, military personnel, and diplomats anywhere in the world. That might be assassinations. We could see the Shia militias in Iraq turned loose against American personnel. We could see that.
I understand that you speculated to a couple of our producers that we might even see attacks on Trump properties. Is that right?
Well, I'm not suggesting that that is likely to happen, but imagine the Iranians blew up a Trump hotel. That was it. I was getting to that at the far end of things. And I want to tell you, don't want to suggest to your listeners that I think this is likely. But if that happened, then we'd be in the peculiar position of having the president of the United States in a position to use American military resources to defend its private property, which would make everybody uncomfortable, to put it mildly. But, you know, there's a whole range of things involved from targeting individuals, either military, diplomatic, or private, to from cyber attacks, attacks on property, sort of faster operations tempo in the Middle East through Hezbollah, Hamas, and Shia militias in Iraq. All those things could happen.
So a couple of other questions for you. We had a caller on one of our earlier segments today who suggested that they thought perhaps the president was using this as a way to take troops out of Iraq. And we've heard other, you know, analysts suggest that that is possible. Do you think that that either intentionally or unintentionally has played into the hand of the withdrawal of troops from Iraq over time for the United States?
It's fascinating because one of Soleimani's goals and continues to be an Iranian goal is to get the United States out of the Middle East, out of Iraq immediately, out of the Middle East altogether. Trump also says he wants to do that, but nobody wants to do what the other guy wants. It's a very strange kind of situation in that respect. Many of the Trump's critics will say either he's done this in order to get out, or he's done this in order to stay in big time. You know, they both can't be right. And I think, frankly, the president is undecided as to what he really wants in Iraq. He'd like these wars to stop, but he doesn't want to leave a vacuum for ISIS, for the Islamic State, which is
arguably what happened when the Obama administration, and I do have to point out you served in the Obama administration, pulled troops out of Iraq in 2011. That really arguably led to the emergence of ISIS. So that would be a real consideration here.
Well, I ought to say that I spent more time serving under President Bush than I did under President Obama, but in both cases in a non-political role. And I think it's right to say that I think that President Obama's decision to pull troops, too many troops out of Iraq, was an error. And he then had to put them back. I think we're there for some considerable time. You know, as Colin Powell said years ago, it's a sort of a pottery barn rule. You break it, you own it. And we've broken it. The invasion of Iraq was a disaster. The only party that's really gained from it has been Iran.
We have
and we're dealing with that.
We have not a lot of time left. I have two additional questions I want to ask. The first is, how important are our allies right now? And would we be in a better position if we'd involved them prior to the drone strike?
We didn't even involve the leadership in the Congress before the drone strike. I think that the drone strike was taken on short notice. But we need our allies. We need to be closer to them than this president is inclined to be, and that's a serious mistake. The United States does not want to be alone in the world. We have powerful, important allies, and we need to keep them on board. I think they're inclined to be on board at this point. And the Iranians are playing a difficult game because by taking themselves by continuing to enrich uranium in violation of the agreement that the Europeans still want to keep in place, they're alienating the Europeans. So they're in a tight spot. This is difficult for us, but much more difficult for them.
And we're going to have to leave it there. Joel Brenner is the former Inspector General of the National Security Agency and head of U.S. counterintelligence in the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, now a senior research fellow at MIT. You joined us via Skype. Thanks so much for doing so.
You're most welcome.
And that is our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Walter Wuthman, and Sarah Rose Brenner. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi, and I'm Tiziana Dearing. And I'm inviting you to join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.